so we are in the process of putting that together. So, but the photo that we take, that was submitted, is one that we take every year as A, to meet the PDD requirements, and as part of our inventory process.
Okay. So, time expected time frame on that?
I would think within the next few weeks or something.
Okay, so maybe before our next meeting, we could have that for our packet. You could just get it to Mr.
I would think we should be able to.
Okay. And then as far as the comments from citizens on the informational pamphlet, yes, we did sit here and make edits. There seems to be a little process complication. My expectation was that Mr. Liberta, the director of administration, was giving us this draft for us to look at. I said to him on the phone that there are some things in here that I don't believe are correct. We're going to take it to the committee meeting. I think we need to make some corrections. I asked several questions of Clint, who corrected some of the things, specifically that the asphalt manufacturing is not being in the pit, which I knew. We got that clarified. A couple other changes. We made those changes. Joel got busy. He didn't get the changes back to the director of administration. However, the director of administration should have known better to either contact myself or Joel to say, hey, we're going to go put this out to print. Did you have any changes? So lack of communication. So you end up with an article in the newsletter that's incorrect and doesn't include the changes that we all worked hard to put together. So I've let them know. Joel apologized. He said he was busy. I get that. But I still think before, I don't care who goes and puts something in the newsletter for print, you need to verify if you're sending a draft to a committee that it's ready. Now, I was expecting it might not even go in until the next one, and we would have time to work on the website updates as well. Well, it's out there. It's not correct. The website never got updated. I just don't understand the communication process here. Mr. Liberta said he was going to get the changes from Mr. Deedle and at least make it correct on the website, so that way the website would read at least with the corrections. It would be a little different than what was mailed out. Did he talk to you about that, Mr. Deedle?
Yes, I gave a copy to him and to Lisa.
Okay. Do you know if that was updated?
Do not know.
Okay.
It was last week that I gave it to him.
Okay. There, you know, it frustrates me because I do most of my work from my home, and a lot of these people are passing each other in the hallways. So it's very frustrating when I'm not seeing the communication take place. That's an internal thing. I don't know how to fix that. I don't have any control over that. All I can do is make my comments known. I did close the citizen comment period.
I just want to make one comment, if I may. I think it's wrong. But we talk about communications.
Yes.
And in November of last year, you guys found out that the outside monitoring, wasn't working. We've talked about communication since November of 2018, and we're still hearing the same thing?
Yes.
Somebody's got to be fired or reprimanded because the communication is supposed to run downhill. And it's been November, and you guys didn't know about the problem with the seismograph. Now we're hearing you didn't know about the complaints, you don't know about this. I feel like I'm in a carnival show. And that's... I just had to get that off my chest.
I'm sorry. Once I open it up, then I'm, you know, pretty soon everybody will be talking. So we need to move on. I get your point. One of the things the council members could put on the agenda is we do have something called policy and procedures. In the past, I've tried to put it on the agenda and get it updated. It was a fight to get it on there, and I get it on the agenda, and nothing ever happens with it. So I work hard to make those points, but again, you got to have everybody on board with that. And, you know, my suggestion is you have three aldermen listening. You got to get one other alderman on board with you. You have to start making those calls to that other alderman at least, or two. Because there's not enough votes to push anything forward without you complaining to someone else that's not sitting in this room. Okay, so that's where we're at with the pamphlet. We're hoping for better communication. I made it very clear to staff of my disappointment and how that happened. Consideration for a suggested resolution via the detailed write-up to the Common Council related to the survey. I guess I'd like to hear the presentation from the quarry before we talk about this, because there might be some enlightening information. So if there's no objection, I'd like to go to the presentation on item C by VibroTech regarding the monitor.
First of all, thank you. I don't know if what we're going to talk about is going to be specific to that item, but we appreciate you bumping up. You know, it's sitting through these meetings, we know a lot of people have questions, concerns with the blasting, and what we want to do is really bring in our consultant that is doing all our monitoring for us to explain what they're doing, why they're doing it, and then why they're measuring what they are and what the effects from blasting can or can't be. So we brought in Mike Spores, who's with VibroTech. He's an area manager with them, so he will give a presentation. Alderman Wilhelm, do you want him to use the microphone?
There's a microphone right here at the table. You want to use that?
Just as a precursor to this, Payne Dolan did supply me through Lon asking and requesting the information on the blasting. Since
I got it.
I sent it to all of you, so all of you have that information for January and February in terms of the numbers and the location of the monitors. So I just want to let you know that most of the people have received that here, so we can embellish or expand on it.
Thank you. And Mike, just to hit on that point before we get off of it, all that information came right off of VibroTech's website, where all that information is stored, and the city has access to that website and all that information as well.
Then I should have it, if I can access it.
I send it out.
Okay, so thank you. My name is Mike Spores. Can everybody hear me on this? It's good. As Quint introduced, I'm VibroTech. We are a national company, independent monitoring firm that monitors blasting operations, and I've been asked to come here tonight to just provide a little bit of education about what it is that I basically do for a living and what my company does. And so we're going to give some background on just seismology, big picture. I'll try to keep it as brief as I can, but there is a necessary amount of background to make sure everybody understands it. But just some basics of what we are looking at when we're monitoring blasting operations, what the regulations and the research tells us from that, and all that information that goes into the regulations and what Payne Dolan is working with as far as that's concerned. And then at the end, we are going to share the results that we've monitored for. I've got over the last past year of the vibration data that we're gonna show at the very end as well. So that I just go into just a little bit more background, just, you know, who I am and our company is. VibroTech is the largest independent third-party monitoring consulting firm for man-made vibration in the U.S. We have over 19 offices actually now in the United States, and we've had over 60 years of experience in this industry monitoring blasting operations. Here at Franklin, in fact, we've been monitoring for over 15 years now at this quarry site here. And I've been doing this for 12 years, and I've been monitoring up here for that whole time as well. So the first thing we need to do to understand blasting vibrations is just do a little bit of quick background on general wave theory to understand how that ground vibration wave moves through the earth. So this is just a nice picture to illustrate what is happening in the ground, because we can't necessarily see those vibration waves. You've all seen a rock thrown into a pond in the water. It's the same type of phenomenon that's going on in the ground as you see in the water with the rock going into a pond. The waves are largest near that center point, and then as it goes out in all directions, the waves decrease in amplitude and in frequency as they go out in all directions until eventually they taper off and you can no longer see those waves in the water. The same thing is happening in the ground. The ground vibrations are largest at the blast site within the quarry, and then as those vibrations go out in all directions, they reduce a little bit each way in every direction until eventually they taper off and are no longer able to be felt. Go ahead. So blasting in general, a lot of people don't know what happens in the quarry with the blasting operation. It's not just throwing a stick of dynamite down the hole and letting it rip like you see in an old Western movie or something like that. It's an engineering and scientific feat to carry off a blast successfully in a quarry operation. So this can be done in a whole number of highly sensitive situations, and I've put a couple of examples up here just now to illustrate that. But this is the Crazy Horse Monument, where they're actually using explosives to actually shape the monument itself. And they're able to do this other blasting without damaging, you know, previous stuff that's already been done on the monument. And then at the bottom here is a courthouse in Nashville where they were blasting out for a parking garage underneath. That's a historic courthouse. They're blasting within 60 feet of it. That without damaging the structure, there's historic frescoes and statues and things in. So blasting is something that is able to be done in tight quarters and done successfully without causing any damage in extreme situations. What's happening on a quarry site, if you go to the next slide there, just to give an idea, a blast site is made up of many different holes that are drilled into the rock. And then each individual hole is loaded with explosive, and then those holes are detonated on a staggered pattern milliseconds apart. So not any one blast contains all of that all at one time. It's broken up into pieces so that, you know, to help with the vibration. And then as a result, you end up with that waveform with how the holes interact with each other and leave the site. So the whole idea of a blasting operation is to make big rocks into little rocks. And so the explosive does its job by creating stress cracks in the rocks and then expanding those cracks into a point where they go towards the free face and the rock breaks up. About ideally 90-95% of the explosive energy is used in this process. That's what the quarry wants. The more that they can get to do that job, the better. What's left over, unfortunately, there is some that is not used in that process. It would be waste energy. That goes out in the form of vibration and air overpressure. Go ahead. So just how that leaves the site, again, this is some basic wave theory, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about here. This is just the wave, just taking a string and pulsing that string, the wave moving across the screen from left to right. But what we're actually looking at here is looking at the individual particles as that energy moves from left to right. That's what we're measuring, the movement of the Earth as that wave energy comes through. And what you'll notice is you do see the wave energy going from left to right, but if you just focus in on some of the particles or one particle, you see that it moves back and forth. And this is happening on a microscopic level that you can't see. So it's blown up here. But you'll notice that as it moves, it returns back to its starting position. There's very little actual movement that happens in the Earth. It's less than a sheet of paper, the amount of movement that's actually happening. Just another simple way to try to understand this, if you go to the last one, Derek, is this is like the wave in a sporting event. You know, the wave is created and it goes around the stadium. But that's all created by individual people in their seats, standing up and down in their seats. So the people are like the particles in the Earth. We're measuring how quickly and how often they're standing up and sitting down in their seats. We're not measuring how fast it's going around the stadium. So what we're measuring, and you've heard some of these terms before, there's two main variables, is the peak particle velocity. That's measured in inches per second. That's the magnitude of that wave. And then we're also measuring the frequency of the wave. That's the number of oscillations in a second, the number of times it goes up and down in a second. That's measured in hertz. That's being measured three-dimensionally. So inside the seismograph, which I'll show a picture of in a minute, there's that ground vibration is being measured in three planes, two horizontal planes, longitudinal, transverse, the L and the T, and then, of course, a vertical component of that motion as well. We're measuring both of those variables, among other things. On those three planes. This is just a picture of some seismograph monitor equipment. This is what is used to monitor that motion. You have portable devices on the left here. And then what we use here at Franklin Quarry and other places is what you see on the right. This is more of a remote, semi-permanent station where the sensor gets buried into the ground, and then it has a modem and communication component, so you can get more real-time feedback of the data there, and you get more consistent readings because you don't have a blaster or somebody coming and setting up the seismograph every single day and a little bit differently. So you get consistent readings and taking out user error with that. So this is the seismograph record. This is a typical record of what it looks like. So after the blast happens, the seismograph records that data and prints it onto the computer, a portion of the seismograph, and it's not able to be edited in any way, and immediately send that information out then to whoever's looking at that data. Here it's myself and the quarry, and ultimately the city. So what you see on every seismograph report is those three motion ground vibration channels here over time. So this is about a 5-second event. So the vibration happens on those three channels, and then you also have the sound component here as well on the bottom channel. On the upper right of every seismograph report, you're going to have, this is your compliance data. We're going to go ahead and show a little bit more of that detail about how we arrive at that information, why it's on there in a bit here. And then on the upper left, you have all of your header information, the date and time, the location, the seismograph, all the technical information about, you know, the range and the calibration information and all that. So I want to go into some of the historical research that's been done in the field, and there has been a lot. It's been a long time. This is not the first community that's adjacent to a quarry. It's been like that. There's been lots and lots over many years, so it's been studied extensively. The main agency that did this was the United States Bureau of Mines. Their biggest study was what's called RI-8507, and I will put up a link at the end of this where you can actually go and read that document yourself if you like. This is by far the largest and most widely accepted study in the industry. And it was conducted by looking at a variety of homes next to a blasting operation to try to develop a universal criteria that could be used to in all situations for any number of type of homes. So they looked at 219 different production blasts in this study and then combined that with many, many years of previous data to come up with conclusions out of this study. In this study, if you go to the next, Derek, they looked at, as I mentioned, try to develop a universal criteria. So they looked at several different types of homes. We have different size homes, one story, two story, brick, wood frame houses, plaster, older homes, or you have newer drywall homes, which is what we have really here in this area, one and a half story, two story homes, to try to come up with a criteria that would be applicable for all types of houses. So what they did is they actually outfitted these houses in this study with actual strain gauges to measure the stress and strain in the homes as they were impacted by vibrations from blasting, and measured and compared that to the ground vibration outside of the home so that they could develop a criteria for the ground vibration out of the home that would be appropriate to not cause any damage. And they actually measured and saw where real damage did occur in the houses from this study. And this is actually a plot of their data, or some of their data here. This is all the data points here are when they observed damage from blasting vibrations in these houses. And so you'll see there's three different types of damage that they quantified in this report. The first type of damage that you'll see is what they call threshold damage. This is mostly cosmetic damage. The first parts of the house that are going to be affected by vibration are going to be the interior walls. They're above ground. They're free to respond to the vibration. So plaster, drywall is the most brittle portion of a house. It's the first thing that's going to get damaged, and that was borne out by the data. Those are the data points on the bottom that you see there. Those are the first places they saw damage. Then you go to minor damage. Those are slightly larger cracks. And then, of course, major damage where you start having structural issues as well. So, of course, that's you can see the average of those lines, and, of course, as you go higher up, it's more and more types of damage. So the data, just looking at the data again here, so what they found as far as the levels for inches per second that they found for threshold damage, that first part of damage was at 2.8 inches per second. They found that there's a 50% probability that you would see some threshold or cosmetic damage. It wasn't until you got to 5.4 or 6.5 inches per second that you actually started to see more significant damages getting into larger cracks and structural damages. So what they ended up with out of all that, if you take this graph here and actually superimpose it back on where all that data was, they wanted to draw their limits in a place that would be sufficiently conservative that you would not have any damage. So this curve that they ended up here with is below all of that damage. So no damage was observed in that study below this curve. So the idea is in this area here, you're in a safe zone that should not cause any damage to a structure. So what we're looking at in this graph are those two variables that we talked about earlier, peak particle velocity and frequency. Before they did this study, the thought was a flat 2 inches per second is safe for everybody. That was back the thought in the 60s and the 70s until they started to do this and look at it further. And they determined that we need to also look at frequency. The frequency is important because every house and structure has its own natural frequency that it responds to. Sort of like the opera singer singing with the glass. If you match that natural frequency, you can have an amplification and the structure will respond more and have more potential for causing damage at a lower level. So that's why if you go back and look at previous damage, there was some damage that was observed below 2 inches per second in those lower frequencies. So as a result, they limited the peak particle velocity at the result of the study at these lower frequencies that match natural frequencies of homes to a lower level. Older construction is 0.5 for plaster, 0.75 for drywall. And then the old limit of 2 inches per second was acceptable as long as you're above 40 hertz. That's a high enough frequency vibration that it just kind of goes right under the house and doesn't respond as much to it, so it's not as susceptible to damage. So they developed, this was their main conclusion from this, and this has been adopted widely since that time and been studied many times since that point in time. And I've been doing this for 12 years. As I mentioned, my company's been doing it for 60 years. We're not aware of any verifiable blasting damage that's occurred below this Z curve here. So if you go to the next